We're burning it on the grate like a barbecue.
Yeah.
Okay. The design and maintenance and operational complexity of these plants is just out of this world.
It's probably the only energy generating technology where people pay you for your fuel.
Wow. We're talking about black bin bag rubbish.
Yes.
Here. This sounds filthy. Hello, everybody. Quentin here. And this week's episode is a load of rubbish. We're talking energy from waste. And this whole world of how this works is absolutely fascinating. So I hope you enjoy this conversation between me and Mark Shatwell from Fichtner Consulting Engineers. This guy knows about burning rubbish like nobody else on the planet. It's incredibly complicated and a key part of our society. So really keen to hear what you think of this one. Check it out and then let us know in the comments. Hit like, subscribe, and all the good stuff. Hello, Mark. Thanks for coming on the podcast and
Hi. Welcome. Yes, thank you. Happy to be here.
Oh, well, that's very kind. Look, I guess the first thing to say is for everyone listening and for you, I sort of tricked you into this podcast. So we discussed you guys coming on and talking about all the amazing things that Fichtner's working on in the energy sector.
Yeah.
And then basically we're going to talk about energy from waste from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I know you wanted to talk about loads of other stuff, but this thing is so interesting. And of all the people who know about it, we've got you on who, we'll talk about your background, but you've worked in this sector. You've working on energy from waste for a long, long time and working on lots of different projects. So we thought, why not go deep down this rabbit hole with you? So before we get started, Mark, thanks for coming on. And do you want to just explain who Fichtner is or what Fichtner is?
Yeah, okay. So Fichtner was founded in 1922. It's a family-owned company in Germany based in Stuttgart. And then they formed a joint venture with our founder was Nick Gamble in 1991 in Stockport. And then we've kind of grown from a couple of employees to now like 150.
And it's a consultancy. Do you guys call yourself a consultancy?
Yeah, so we're an independent engineering consultancy and we support the deployment of lots of different energy types, as you mentioned. So I guess we're going to talk about energy from waste, and Fichtner's growth has been built on energy from waste, really, from the mid-1990s onwards. But we also do, you know, all types of thermal power generation, energy storage, hydrogen, carbon capture, biofuels, solar, wind, you know, anything that generates power, really, or stores power.
Awesome. And then the big reveal is that you used to work with Tim, who's,
yes,
of course, Modo co-founder with me.
Yeah.
And you guys, you taught him everything he knows, right?
Well, yeah, I'd like to think so. Yeah, yeah. So Tim joined us from university. Like, I interviewed him. And I can't remember how long he's with us now, but we worked together on the EnviroCover Energy from Waste plant, which I understand you guys have been to visit not too far from here, near Kidderminster.
Awesome. Let's talk about you for a second, right? Okay. So what have you been working on before you got to this pinnacle of your career being on the Modo podcast?
Yeah.
What's your background, Mark? What have you been working on? And then we're going to go deep into this energy from waste thing.
So I'm a mechanical engineer by background, graduated from Imperial College London in 2006, I think it was now, which makes me feel old, especially with you guys here. But my career sort of tracks the change in UK power generation, really. So from university, I joined Parsons Brinckhoff, which then became part of Balfour Beatty's, now WSP. And I was doing thermodynamic modelling for CCGT in the Middle East. So these were massive.
CCGT being what?
Yeah, combined cycle gas turbine. So, you know, now the Middle East is looking at hydrogen and solar, but then it was all about big gas-fired power stations for power and water, you know, desalination. And then the
desalination.
Yeah.
That, just to be clear, right? That's taking seawater and turning it to water that you can drink.
Yeah.
And that's what they have to do all over the Middle East because there ain't lakes and reservoirs.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So they were doing that by thermal desalination, so by using steam and effectively boiling the seawater to get pure water out the other end. So very energy intensive. So that was, thermodynamic modelling. And then the other thing that I was doing was performance testing on coal stations. So I went to Egborough coal station, now demolished, Rugeley coal station, And we were doing, it's called like boiler over fire air. So at the time, they were looking to make coal stations, you know, produce less NOx, and we were doing baseline monitoring. So as a graduate, I was like sat on top of this like air preheater, sweating, getting static shocks off this probe that I'm literally holding in the flow of flue gas. So yeah, I was thinking, this isn't what I went to university for.
There's got to be some rules around that, yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, that was kind of, you know, the last hurrah of coal generation, really. So I was at PB for a year, and then I joined Siemens Power Generation in Energy Service Fossil. And I said this to a colleague the other day who actually booed me for being in fossil generation.
Not at all, right? So yeah. Our country still, the globe still requires on burning stuff to make electricity. Mm-hmm. And there's a very complicated mechanical, chemical process, and electrical, of course. And that's the crucial bit. You need the electrical bit at the end. And this is fascinating. Yes, hopefully we're not doing it in 50 or 100 years' time, hopefully. Yeah. That doesn't mean it's not fascinating. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be putting loads of resources into making it better right now.
Yeah.
Just wanted to jump in with that.
Yeah, we're not thank you.
The anti-fossil booing lobby, I don't think.
Yeah, so Energy Service Fossil. So I actually initially went back to Rugeley.
Rugeley being a big coal power station.
Yeah, and so this was built, you know, in the 1970s, like a lot of them near coal mines, basically. CEGB, so the Central Electricity Generating Board, you know, before it was all privatized. And this plant, when I went back, so they were putting in flue gas desulfurization. So that's
flue gas is exhaust.
Yes.
Right?
So, yeah, yeah. Sorry. So when you burn the gas, when you burn the coal, it's the gas that comes off, you know, along with the combustion air. And in coal, you know, depending on where it comes from, you have some sulfur. You know, sulfur comes out of sulfur dioxide, and that can mix with water to get acid rain.
The nasty stuff.
Yeah. And so they were putting in flue gas desulfurization, which is where you dose lime and it reacts with the sulfur dioxide to take it out.
Lime, as in like limestone lime?
Yes, limestone.
Not squeezing limes.
No, as in, yeah, quarried limestone. And we'll come back onto this in our EFW discussion.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, so they were spending a lot of money on coal, and that was to help them, you know, keep running longer. You may remember, I think it was the Lars Combustion Plant Directive said that to run above a certain number of hours, you had to have this desulfurization process. And they were putting in new turbine rotors, and what we were doing was refurbishing one of these 500 megawatt generators to replace. And so I was working there, you know, at Rugeley. So a lot of money spent. I don't know if they ever recovered it because they didn't run that many years longer after that. And then also at Siemens, so gas, we said combined cycle gas turbine. I worked on probably one of the last new build CCGT plants, which was down in Marchwood in Southampton, which probably, you know, is still running today. Probably one of the most efficient plants still providing.
What, built after Langage?
After Langage, yeah. So there was Marchwood, and then there was Severnside, and then there is Carrington Trafford. So this was built in the 2000s.
Carrington Trafford, is that the one? No, we're going back now a long time. Is that the one that won a capacity market contract ago, and then they just didn't build it? Or they did build it? Did they build it in the end?
So
because there was a load of drama, right? They got this amazing capacity market contract when capacity market was just taking off.
Yeah.
And then it just got pushed back and back and back.
So there is one that's operating Carrington. I've been round it. And then they were going to build a second one next to it. And that might be the one that you're thinking.
Still not built.
Still not built. I don't think ever will be built. They've looked at, they're now looking, I think, to build a hydrogen and battery plant on the same site. Because we've supported them with that planning.
Anyway, this is the problem, right? There's so much interesting stuff to talk about.
So then I joined Fichtner in 2010. And as I say, I sort of, around that time was PFI, and that led to a lot of councils building energy from waste plants. So they were sort of borrowing this money essentially through the government. And it was driven also by landfill tax. So landfill tax went up to like 80 odd pound a ton, which made it uneconomic for the councils to keep landfilling wastes. And so they were looking to build energy for waste plants.
We as humans are producing all of this rubbish that was going to landfill. And then they started taxing it much higher. And council said, what on earth are we going to do with it?
Yeah.
And then the boom of energy from waste, is that right?
Yeah. So some of the oldest energy from waste plants operating now were built like in the mid-90s. So you've got the Midlands plants, you've got Stoke, Wolverhampton, Dudley. It was built, mid-90s. And then probably from 2005 onwards, there was then a big boom, a lot of it pushed by this PFI.
Okay.
We'll get into that in a bit, I suppose. But just to sort of, I guess, finish off my career trajectory. So, a lot of energy from waste from there. But then also biomass. So the renewables obligation meant that quite a few virgin wood biomass plants were built. And also worked with Estover. I think you know the Estover guys, and they built a lot of CHP wood plants. So they were, as well as generating electricity, they were providing heat. So they were based on industrial sites, one of which was like the Macallan whiskey distillery. So they were providing steam for the distilling process.
Yeah.
That was the RO and energy from waste. And then the next thing was capacity market came in. And then at the time, the idea was this was going to build new, secure, dispatchable power. And a lot of people thought that was going to lead to a new wave of CCGTs. And so I supported a client that was looking to build two brand new CCGTs. We specified them. We went into contract negotiation. But then the capacity market has never yet closed high enough to incentivize a new build CCGT. So they didn't happen. And now I'm still working on a couple.
That is probably one of the top three elephants in the room about the whole UK electricity system, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Which is that still the capacity market has not stimulated new build CCGT.
No.
All these years afterwards.
We essentially replaced coal and new build CCGT with gas peakers.
Yeah. Ah, we could do a whole episode on the capacity market. Not my favourite thing. Anyway, it's like Marmite, isn't it? Actually, does anyone love the capacity market?
Gas peakers.
Gas peakers, yeah. Oh, I think it's a disaster.
I mean, there's still hope among CCGT developers that this February, might be the one. But we'll see.
Well, fingers crossed. What we do need is new, cleaner gas, efficient CCGT plants in this country.
Yeah.
Pretty fast. All right, cool. And then you've been at Fichtner the last few years, working on a load of different things.
Yeah.
Let's talk about energy from waste now. So energy from waste, or EFW.
Yeah.
This is, and I'm going to ask some silly questions now just to make sure we know what we're talking about. This is taking rubbish that would have gone to landfill.
Yeah.
So black bin bag rubbish.
Black bin bag, yeah.
Pulling it all together, burning it.
Yeah.
Taking the energy from burning it and turning that into electricity.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And so these plants, how big are they and where are they?
Okay, so they're kind of everywhere in the UK. You may not kind of notice them, but obviously the bin lorries drive from, collect your bin and drive directly to the FW. So you don't want them too far apart. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there is also some waste that goes, gets bulked and sent on trains to different plants, but mainly they tip directly into a bunker, so a big pit. Yeah. So they're all over the country, throughout the UK. The biggest one is in Runcorn, so that takes all of Greater Manchester's waste. That actually does take a lot of waste via train, because it has a train depot there.
So there's train carriages full of rubbish from other places coming through to be burnt in this place.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And so that is four lines, and it is about a million tons of waste a year.
That sounds like a really big number, but I don't know what that is in black bin bags. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
I don't know. Obviously, it depends what you put. It depends what you throw away. I mean, polystyrene, not so much. So, okay. So Runcorn, and how many megawatts is that?
So Runcorn's slightly complicated because it also provides heat because it's on the INEOS site. So INEOS, former ICI, makes lots of...
great cycling teams. They make a lot of great cycling teams.
Yeah, they make cycling teams. They also make a lot of chemicals. Yeah. So they take quite a lot of heat. Maybe a better example is Ferrybridge. So Ferrybridge, former coal station.
Yeah.
shut down but has two energy from waste plants built on the cricket pitch and the golf course. And between them, they're also 1.4 million tonnes a year, both around 70 megawatts, so 140 megawatts of electricity.
140 megawatts. That's not actually that many megawatts, is it, for so many tonnes of
waste. It's not that much. So they're not the most electrically efficient plants. Typically, you're looking at between, depending on the age, 25 to 30% net efficiency.
Net efficiency.
So if you compare that to CCGT, which can be as high as 60 with the latest gas turbine.
So the most efficient gas plant you can buy at the moment is sort of late 50s, 60%, right, CCGT. Yeah. What about gas peakers? Where do they sit?
They're around mid-40s.
Mid-40s. Yeah. And then burning energy from waste. I won't call it burning from rubbish, but that's kind of what it is. That's in the 20s.
Yeah. Or it can be up to 30. So okay. Ferry Bridge is probably 30, one of the newest ones. And they were built by SSE, right? So they come from a power background and they pushed the efficiency.
Nice. And do these things run all the time? I mean, are they like, but is it 24-7, go?
Yeah, absolutely 24-7, they're base load. So,
base load
you
power.
Know, they are, yeah, I guess they're displacing, the more you build, they're displacing some of the gas base load.
So we're going to talk in a minute about what is involved at these plants to make it happen. I'm sure it's very complicated. But before we get there, let's just take it back a step. So if we... you and I, Mark, want to build an energy from waste plant. Yeah. Let's say we've got a load of land somewhere and a grid connection and planning permission. One of the fascinating things about energy from waste that I want to get to is the way the business case works, because it's a little bit different from most things. So if you build a gas plant, what you care about is, you know, what's your gas cost, your carbon cost, your capex, and then your operational costs, and then how much you make from the electricity. Mm-hmm. And you're building the plant to make money from electricity.
Yeah.
But energy from waste is different, right? How is it different?
So the majority of your revenue comes from the gate fee. So it's probably the only energy generating technology where people pay you for your fuel.
Wow. So what is a gate fee?
So literally the lorry turns up full of waste. There's a weighbridge when you come in. They weigh the lorry when it comes in. It tips into the bunker. They weigh it when it goes out. And they charge you for every ton of waste that you've tipped in the bunker.
They charge you for... So the energy from waste plant charges the lorry for taking the
waste. Disposing the waste, like you would if you put it in a tip or a landfill.
And do you have any idea, I've put you on the spot here, apologies, but how much per... What's a gate fee in roughly? Is it tens of pounds, hundreds of pounds, thousands of pounds for a lorry?
There is a huge range, partly because of, PFI and now merchant plants, but it can go from sort of £50 at the low end to maybe £120 at the top end. And so under PFI, what the council did was they went to competitive tender and the companies that wanted to build the energy from waste plants bid a gate fee, essentially. Okay. So, and then that contract was set for 20, 25 years.
So a bit like a bidding for a CFD. If you're a wind plant, you'll bid for a gate fee if you want to build energy from waste.
Yeah, but just to that council. And so the idea is the gate fee is that it paid back the capital cost of the plant as well as obviously made a profit for the developer.
Mm.
But then the council would look at it as like, well, it's going to cost me this much, you know, to landfill it. So then as long as the gate fee is coming in similar, then everybody wins in a way.
So at some point in time, we decided as a society that we didn't want to stick things into landfill anymore and we wanted to do energy from waste instead.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is it for the electricity price, are they locking in long-term PPAs on these prices or are they just taking the market? How does that work?
So I don't work in that much, but traditionally they've locked in a PPA and it's just a flat rate because they're base load. This is changing, but traditionally the electricity is a kind of nice to have byproduct. The main thing is about burning waste. So unusually, again, for a power plant, almost all energy from waste plants have a bypass around the turbine. So if the turbine trips, you still want the plant to keep running. And even if the turbine is out, you still want to just keep burning the waste because that's what generates the money. And also because you don't want trucks backing up and there are penalties if you can't take the waste.
This is fascinating. So whatever happens, is it a furnace? Do you call it a furnace?
That
furnace is going, right? You're burning this waste.
Yeah.
And then hopefully, ideally, 100% of the time, the turbine's running and you're generating electricity.
Yeah.
But if it's not, you're still going to take that waste, right? Because otherwise the rubbish is going to come. Just keep on coming.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the plant for a second. Mm-hmm. So I imagine there's a, what is the plant? There's a big road that comes into it because you need all these lorries. I imagine there's lots of potholes on that road. And then the lorries tip into something and then you burn it and then there's a generator. What's involved?
So there's, they come in, they go over the weighbridge, like we said, and then there's a tipping hall. So then that has a series of bays. Again, a bit like you might have at your local tip. The vehicles reverse into the bays and tip into the bunker, which is a big concrete pit.
How big's a bunker, just to give an idea? Is it like a sport, like it's like a football pitch or a sports hall or a...
Yeah.
I don't know. What's
it? Obviously, it varies with the size of the plant, but it could be, Runcorn is probably at least two football pitches, and then they might be 30 to 40 meters from the bottom of the pit to the hopper, which is where you tip the waste, and they might have anything 12 bays. I think Envirocore was like 8 bays. So
surely this thing's like, this might be a silly question, sorry, but if you've got two football pitches in like ground coverage, and you're tipping the rubbish off off the side from a truck, doesn't it all go at one end? Do you have to move it? It's like
a bit. So the cranes move it, and one of the jobs of the crane. So generally they spend like a third of the time feeding the boiler, a third of the time mixing the waste, and the rest of the third of the time like stacking. So what the crane has to do as they tip is the crane has to like dig a trench, and they will move the waste to the back so you can stack it as a slope. And as it gets fuller and fuller, you can start to close off bays so that the bunker's like completely full in that area.
And this is, again, just we're talking about black bin bag rubbish.
Yes.
Here. This sounds filthy.
Yeah, and it is. And I mean, if you look in, because from the control room, there's a window into the bunker because the cranes can be automated, but sometimes they're driven manually. So it's a bit like an arcade. You know, we have a joystick and a grab. It's like the teddy picker, basically. And you get in there. You get all sorts of things. You know, you can get sort of even engine blocks, car parts, like turn up in there. And then there's also always like video cassette, like tape stuck to the crane.
And then, so that's a good question, right? Before we get to making the electricity or generating electricity, all this rubbish. How do you know? An engine block? Can you burn an engine block?
No.
Here's
you
examples
can't.
Of silly things that are in there. So have you got to sift through it somehow?
No. So I talked before a little bit about a gate fee, right? So the lowest gate fee is for waste that is like pre-sorted. So you can have things that are called like MRF, material recycling centres. And there they can sort the waste, take out any recyclables, shred the waste, and then you get the lowest gate fee for that because it's been pre-treated.
So that's where they're picking the bits of metal out and the good bits that can be recycled, and then you end up with just the rubbish at the end.
Yeah, and then sometimes they'll even shred that waste so it's of a certain particle size.
Like a grading.
Yeah.
Is shredding it better for burning it?
It's better for burning it, yes, but... Again, going back to the business case, what you want as an EFW is the highest possible gate fee, and you actually want the lowest calorific value of the waste, so the lowest energy in the waste, because you're charging people per ton, and so I almost want to draw a firing diagram with my hands, right? But you need so much thermal input.
If you're listening, there is quite a lot of gesticulating happening, and it is really value add.
So... to generate a certain amount of steam, so you will control the plant to a steam flow, right? You need a certain thermal input. But the lower the energy value of the waste, the more you have to burn to get that same thermal input and the more money you generate. So I know like an operator of an EFW plant will get people ringing up going, I've got some really high energy waste here. You know, will you pay me more for it? And like, well, no, actually, I'll pay you less for it because I can't put as much through my plant. So there's a lot of sort of the opposite of the way you would think.
That is nuts. All right, let's come back to what do we call it? The big hall.
The tipping hall and the bunker.
So let's talk about what's the tipping hall. This waste, we talked about it for a second just before we came on. the bottom bit of the waste you have to write off, don't you?
So, yeah, so generally, the tipping hole, you'll have a certain distance below the tipping hole that you can tip into.
And this is the football, this is the two football pitcher sized area, yeah. Just to get everyone on the same, right?
Okay. Yeah, and sometimes the tipping hole is elevated, so sometimes the vehicles go up a ramp, and that's to give you more storage, because as I say, you tip into the bunker, and the deeper your bunker, the less often you have to trench, you know, you have to use the crane to create that space, and the less far you have to dig into the ground, which is all cost. Again, someone said as a rule of thumb, like, it costs 10 times as much to go down as it does to go up.
Yeah,
so it's expensive to dig.
Are these open, by the way, or have they got a ceiling?
No, they've got a ceiling, because you don't want rainwater coming in.
Yeah.
So they're all, and you want to keep the smell in as well. so they're all in, internal.
Do you get nose pegs? Do they give people nose pegs when you go?
Generally, they smell a lot less than you think. In fact, I was talking to your colleague before, who'd been to EnviroCover, and he was impressed by how little it smelled. And the reason is that when you burn stuff, you need to take air in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the primary air extraction is taken from the bunker hole. So there's a negative pressure in the bunker hole, which means that air flows into the bunker hole rather than out.
And takes all the stinkiness into the combustion bit.
Yes.
And then, brilliant.
So the only time they really start to smell is when they're off. And then there are, you know, actually now for single stream plants, the EA insists that you have carbon filtration.
What's the EA, sorry?
The Environment Agency.
Yeah.
So carbon filtration is where, when the plant isn't sucking air in, you have a separate fan that sucks air through a carbon filter to take the smell out and then ejects it at the top.
Okay,
so they're generally not as smelly. But if you're in the bunker hole when it's off, they can be smelly. I've seen people put earplugs up their nose instead.
I can imagine, yeah. I'd be running around looking for those. So we're going to stop talking about rubbish in a second. But that big, so you said it could be 20 metres or so high
that you
tip the back of a lorry into. And it all gets compacted down the bottom, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that stuff, can you still burn that? Or is that just like a residue?
So you can. So you'll have a certain height that the crane can't quite reach, maybe half a meter, and then that's sort of almost there.
That's
forever.
No man's land.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then you get the waste. You grab it, like, I can imagine, you know, going to the seaside and using one of these grabbers, and you grab it and you lift it up.
Yeah.
And you drop it into the next stage, don't you? What happens then?
So then there's a hopper. So you know, a sloped. You know, area like a funnel, yeah, and then it goes into a waste chute, and then from the chute it goes onto the grate, and then, to use another arcade analogy, the grate is like the coin. What do they call it?
The penny machines.
So again, I'm gesticulating, not great for a podcast, but it's called a reciprocating grate. So you have these like steps that are moving.
Also,
in and out.
Like there was that. I don't know if it's still on now. There was ITV did a show that competed with Pointless.
Right.
Which was, I don't know if you saw it, I'm a big Pointless fan, so it annoyed me, and a big BBC fan. And there was it's like a load of count, it's basically that penny machine.
Yeah,
But
Penny Falls.
It's like one of those, and then there's a quiz. Anyway, I digress. So there's so you've got the grate, and what's the grate doing? Is it shaking, or is it?
So it's moving in and out, this reciprocating grate. So if you like, alternate steps are moving in and out, and it's called the ram feeder at the beginning. So there's a ram that literally pushes waste from the chute onto the grate. And what happens is so this is called the drying phase, the like ignition phase, combustion, and then burnout. So as the waste comes on, it's, you know, getting heated up. And you can see this, there's usually cameras on the grate or this window that you can look in at the end.
Whoa, just one second, right?
Yeah.
So this grate, are we burning it on the grate like a barbecue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're barbecuing this rubbish on the grate. The grate's moving and there's cameras. This all sounds very exciting. And so then what happens?
So, so it comes on, dries out, ignites. So there's a big flame and then that produces a lot of hot gas, flue gas that we said before.
The exhaust.
Yeah. And then that's the furnace. And then you have water walls of the furnace, often refractory or Inconel clad, so that's prevent.
What's a water wall?
So you have water walls in every sort of boiler and a coal boiler. So what it means is the walls of the boiler have pipes in that has water in.
Okay.
So the water's boiling, starting to boil in these walls to generate steam.
Okay. We haven't actually generated any electricity yet. We've just had a bit. We just burnt a load of rubbish.
Okay, cool. Yeah, you burn the rubbish, and then I suppose if we follow the flue gas path first, so as it goes up the furnace, you have primary air. So that's the air coming in through the grate, through the bottom of the grate.
Bottom of the barbecue.
Of the barbecue. So when you barbecue, if you open those holes in the bottom, your primary air, essentially. Okay. And then you have secondary air, which comes higher in the furnace. So and what you're trying to also do, go into NOx. So one of the things you generate that you don't really want as a pollutant is NOx, so oxides of nitrogen.
Yeah.
Right, and to avoid NOx...
This is the same stuff that diesel cars produce and
and all stuff. Combustion. So what you do to reduce thermal NOx is you want to avoid stoichiometric conditions.
Oh my! What?
So stoichiometric conditions. If you look at your chemical formula, it's the exact amount of air you need to provide the oxygen for the reaction. And when you have stoichiometric, you have the highest temperatures. And you produce the most NOx. So not there's nitrogen in the air, and at high temperatures it forms with the oxygen to form NOx.
To turn into the nasty stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So you avoid that by first burning rich, which means there's not enough air, and then you burn lean, so you have an excess of air. So the secondary air provides an excess of air, creates the mixing, and ensures you have complete combustion.
Okay, so you're aiming to completely burn this rubbish, but in a couple of different ways to minimise the amount of nitrous oxide stuff that comes out.
Yeah, right. And then you measure in the burn, so then you get ash coming off the end of the grate, which drops into basically like a water pit, so it quenches the ash, and then that's pushed out by a ram onto a conveyor, which goes to an ash storage area, and that's your bottom ash. And they also measure the bottom ash for the total organic carbon, which has to be below a certain amount, and that guarantees that you've burnt it out properly.
Total organic carbon, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that you've got burnout, so that there's no nasties left in it. All that's there is inert.
Okay.
Right? Okay, and then with an energy from waste plant, so...
We still haven't actually made any electricity yet.
But actually, the electricity is the easy bit, in a way. The interesting bit is the burning. So the other thing you have to be wary of when burning waste is so dioxins. Dioxins, PCBs, and furans. So have you heard of those?
No, they don't sound very nice, though.
No. So
I wouldn't invite them to my party.
So in the 1970s, we used to incinerate waste, and there was incidence of increased rates of cancer and birth abnormalities around people that lived near incinerators.
Right, serious stuff.
Yeah, and that's because some dioxins can be carcinogenic. And so when the UK started building, and the whole of Europe started building EFWs again, there was a thing called the Waste Incineration Directive that's now part of the Industrial Emissions Directive. And that said that you had to make sure that the flue gas temperature was above 850 degrees for more than 2 seconds as the flue gas goes through the path.
So the exhaust gas is going up the chimney.
Yeah.
They've got to be above 850 degrees to meet this big regulation that was trying to stop people getting ill from living near
these
things.
So not going up the chimney, but in the furnace.
Okay, in the furnace, right.
Yeah, and what that does is that breaks down the dioxins, PCBs and furans into smaller chain molecules that aren't as harmful. So your first furnace pass is empty. You usually have 1, 2, maybe 3 empty passes, and because you don't want to take too much heat out because you need to be above this 850 for more than 2 seconds. Right? And then the other thing that happens in the furnace, sorry, as we're going through it sort of spatially, is you're also spraying ammonia or urea into the furnace.
Bloody hell, this is complicated, isn't it? I thought you just burn this stuff. You pull out some electricity and Bob's your uncle. Really have to treat.
Yeah, because you've got to...
treat the gases.
Yeah, because this is the thing that sometimes opposition groups against the EFW, comparing it to the 70s, when there were genuine health concerns, there was no abatement. All they did was take out the dust. But now we have to make sure...
So they were just letting the exhaust fumes just go up into the chimneys, right?
Yeah. And so now we have to make sure that what comes out of the chimney is not harmful. And there's I don't know if it's true, but there's an argument in some inner city areas, what comes out of the chimney is cleaner than what went in the first place.
Wow.
Because you've treated, there might have been NOx that went in that you've treated in the plan.
If that is true, can someone, if you're listening, can someone tell us whether that's true or not? Even if it's true or not true, it's still fascinating. So ammonia, right?
Yeah, ammonia. So you dose the ammonia, which reacts with the NOx. So any NOx that you did produce, obviously you would try and produce as little as possible, and you did reacts with the NOx to make it not harmful.
This all sounds very expensive. All of this treat, I guess, because your input fuel is so disgusting.
Yeah.
No wonder, and you have to burn it on a grate like a barbecue.
Yeah.
No wonder you have to do loads of stuff to it afterwards to stop it being
There's more to come, yeah. So right. After you've dosed the ammonia, you've gone through your 850, you then have the soup heater. So you've raised steam in the water walls, then the soup heaters superheat this steam to the temperature you want for the turbine. You go through that section, you go through the economizer. So the economizer is what warms the water before it boils. And then you get to the flue gas treatment plant, right?
So, it's the exhaust gases that are heating the boiler, which makes the steam, which generates electricity, right?
Yeah.
It's not, just to be clear here, because this is a common misconception. So it's the exhaust gases that are doing the work here, yes. Rather than, I don't know, the fire.
Yeah, but obviously the fire
yes.
produces the hot exhaust gases. But yes, so as it goes through, the exhaust gases are getting cooler and cooler, giving up their energy, their heat, to the water, which raises the steam, which eventually makes the electricity.
Okay.
But as the flue gases come out at the end of the boiler, they're typically 150, 140 degrees C. And, they might be a bit higher, but we cool them so they're around that 140 range. And that's the optimal range that we then dose lime. So we talked about before, flue gas desulfurization, we dose lime here, and that reacts with any acid gases. So your sulfur dioxide mainly. And then you also have hydrogen fluoride and hydrogen chloride, right? And that's what would produce acid rain. So we dose the lime that reacts with them, and then they go through to a bag filter. So a bag filter, think of it as like socks hanging down.
Like a Henry Hoover.
Like a Henry Hoover, I guess. Yeah, but there's lots of these sort of long socks hanging down, and they have this metal cage inside which stops them collapsing on themselves. And then the flue gas goes through. So you've got an induced draft fan, so that's pulling a negative pressure that pulls the flue gas through these socks. And then the dust and the reacted lime sits on the outside of these and falls down. And the other thing that we dose here is activated carbon. And so we dose that. So these dioxins that we got rid of by having them at above 850, as the temperature cools, they can actually reform at like sort of 250 degrees C. So we dose carbon. And then any dioxins that do reform are absorbed onto the carbon, which gets taken out of the bag filter and then, you know, mixed into this flue gas treatment residue.
So we've got all these stages of cleaning the exhaust gas. This is a very, there's a lot of things to build, to maintain, to invest in, very complicated process. Mm-hmm. How close to the end are we?
Of the flue gas.
That's
basically it. So you come out of the bag filter, you go to the ID fan, induced draft fan, and then it goes up the stack.
Then it goes up the chimney.
Yeah.
Which we call stacks.
Yeah, we call the stack. And then, obviously, the steam you've produced, which tends to be around 420 degrees C, goes to the steam turbine.
Now we're on to the electricity bit, right?
Yeah.
So it's a steam turbine, and this is just a normal steam turbine.
Standard steam turbine, yeah. So obviously you've got high pressure, high temperature expanded through the steam turbine, makes it spin, turns a generator, produces electricity. Then we condense the steam, usually in an air-cooled condenser.
Cool.
But one of the reasons why, you know, I said EFW, it tends to be 25 to 30% efficiency, which is a lot lower than a coal plant. But it's the same cycle, really. It's the Rankine cycle, right? It's a steam cycle. But the reason that it's a lot lower efficiency, one, you've got higher parasitic load. You know, you've got all these other processes going on.
I was going to ask you about that. You're generating this electricity, but even running this plant must consume a ton of electricity.
So these huge cranes that you're moving about, you're blowing this lime in, you're conveying ash. So your parasitic load is 10 to 12%. But then the main reason that your power output is less is because we can't reach as high temperatures as you can in a coal plant, because the flue gases are full of nasty stuff, right? They're full of chlorine. Chlorine loves to corrode the tubes. And the higher the temperature of the tubes, the faster the corrosion happens. So there's a balance between, you know, getting more electricity out from higher temperature, but not eating through your tubes super fast. So, yeah, that's the main reason. We're restricted to around 420 degrees C, and when you're restricted on temperature, you're also restricted on pressure.
So if I've got this right, in simple terms, because I'm a simple guy, because the input fuel is so, I'm going to say unpredictable, but you guys probably know exactly what's going to be in there, because people are
unpredictable, right? You don't know what it's going
to be. It's dirty, and you don't know what's in there, and you can't really check. You don't know, you know, you got everything from crisp packets to mattresses, right? There's all sorts. And so this wide range of input fuels and horrible NASAs in it means you have to spend a lot of time and effort cleaning up that gas, which has an impact. Has an impact on cost, has an impact on efficiency, has an impact throughout the whole thing. And that means that when you go back to basics, the way these plants make money is by burning waste, not necessarily by making electricity. Is that a fair...
Yeah, that's true. And it's certainly historically been true. I think now, obviously, with electricity prices increasing, there's more and more effort into getting as much electricity out of them as you can. But their primary purpose is still to get rid of the waste.
And I get this is a big societal problem that we need to come to terms with, which is if we're going to produce so much waste, you know, if the bin men don't come one fortnight in a month, people are up in arms. You know, they're not gonna, you know, I pay my. It's like all we care about. We pay our council bill, and it's like, as long as the bin men come, I'm happy. So we need to, as a society, to figure out what on earth are we going to do, because we can't keep on putting it to the ground. Mm-hmm. And so this is our next best solution, and also it generates some electricity. But it's costly, right? There's a cost to it. How much do these plants cost?
200 to sort of, it depends on the size, obviously, right? But for a 200,000 ton a year plant, maybe 250 million.
250 million for 200,000 ton a year. So that's a fifth of the size of the Runcorn one. And that will generate what?
20 megawatts.
20 megawatts. Yeah. So 250 million quid capex on a plant that makes 20 megawatts. Which is why we need to stop thinking about them as energy plants, right? They're waste plants with a bit of energy plants. On top. And then the complexity, the design and maintenance and operational complexity of these plants is just out of this world. For a mechanical engineer like you, you must love it.
They're interesting.
And so... is there anything else about energy from waste that we haven't covered before? I want to give you a chance. We've gone well over time, you see. I'll give you a chance on the last couple of questions that we've started asking. So, but is there anything else on EFW that we haven't covered that you think is interesting?
So I guess, like, where's EFW going in the future, perhaps? You know, because the...
Oh, yeah, you just asked the questions. That's a way better question.
So, I mean, you have to...
one-man podcast. It would be... Honestly, it would be better.
So you have the waste hierarchy, right, which is reduced. So that's like less disposable plastics, reuse. So that's your cup, you know, you cut back to Costa or whatever, recycle, and then recover on, and then disposal. So EFW is right at the end of that chain. So we want to reduce, you know, we want to reduce the amount of waste we produce. It is better to reuse, recycle, but there's always going to be some waste left. And interestingly, one of the things we also get challenged on is carbon. So like energy from waste, you're taking plastics, right? So typically in waste, 50% of the fuel's biogenic, so from organically derived. But then the other 50...
As in the stuff that we can stick into our compost heaps anyway.
You know, you can't necessarily extract it. So it's 50% biogenic, roughly. So it used to be higher, but then we started recycling more paper. So paper's sort of, you know, biogenic originally. So then it went down, and then it could go either way in the future. We might produce less plastics, then the organics could go up. But then we should also, you know, some councils, you just chuck your food in with your black bin, so it all goes to EFW. Some
Really?
Yeah, some have separate food collections and it goes to AD. I mean, that's a whole other podcast you could do on anaerobic digestion. Yeah. So who knows? But we think it was probably going to stay around 50-50. And then there is an argument to say, well, with the plastics, actually you'd be better to landfill that. Because when you burn it in an EFW, you're releasing the CO2 into the atmosphere. Mm. Whereas if you landfill it, you're essentially sequestering that carbon. But then there's two...
That was a lovely word. Sequestering,
yeah.
That's the first time on the podcast.
Oh, really?
We're going to start using that word. Yeah.
So, I mean, when they talk about...
What does it mean, saving it for a future...
Well, locking it away, essentially. So it's not released into the atmosphere. When we talk about CCS, okay, it's carbon capture and storage, but the Escanor system for sequester, so where you put it under the ground.
Okay.
So you could... There's an argument to say, well, we should landfill the plastics, then it's locked away. And that might actually be a sort of strong argument if it was only plastics. The thing with landfill is that a lot of, you know, if it's not just plastics and stuff breaks down, then you tend to, in absence of oxygen, produce methane. That's what anaerobic digestion is. Methane is 25 times more global warming potential than CO2. We try and capture that in landfill gas, burn it in gas engines, but you don't know what you're not capturing. Mm. And, you know, you only need to capture... you only need to release 1 ton of methane for obviously 25 tons of CO2 to have a worse effect. So there's that argument against landfill. And the other one is, well, you're not doing anything with that plastic, right? You took it out of the ground, you went put all that effort to make plastic in, and then you're just putting it back. By burning it, we're generating some electricity. And that electricity is potentially, at the moment, offsetting, you know, base load gas. So we have to do all these carbon calculations as part of the justification. Because this is, again,
I'd never thought
to get
about
planning.
It like that.
Yeah, so at the moment it is better. It is better than landfilling. But not hugely. And if we stop burning gas as base load, then you could argue that, you know, you would be better off not burning in EFW. And so that's then where carbon capture comes in. So...
Well, let's go there.
Yeah.
Sod it. Forget how much time we've got. We'll go over. So, carbon capture and storage. Can you do that? Can you put the Hoover on the exhaust of the energy from waste plant and suck the carbon out and store it? Can you do that?
Yes, you can. Yeah. And at Fichtner, so there's the Bays have launched the carbon capture cluster sequencing program. We're on track one at the minute, and there are four EFWs in that track one, and we're supporting them with their pre-feed studies. So that's looking at, you know, well, basically designing the carbon capture plant, sizing it, costing it, doing the layouts. And so you can, I mean, again, that's probably another podcast on its own, but essentially you're using amine to suck out the CO2, and then you heat up the amine to release the CO2, and then you take the CO2 to store it. And then there are two clusters at the minute that Bayes is supporting. There's the HyNet cluster, which is in the northwest. And
when you say a cluster, these are places, right? These are areas of the country in the UK, which Bayes, the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, right?
Yeah,
they are now supporting these two areas to do special things in.
So what they're basically saying is, you know, it costs quite a bit of money to put in a CO2 pipeline, to run it out into the North Sea, and there needs to be a depleted gas field that you can put it in. So they've identified these two. There is HyNet and East Coast, so that where they will support the infrastructure that then industries that capture their carbon can then put into this pipeline.
Put into the ground. Back in the caverns or whatever that we got methane out from in the first place.
Yes. And so, HyNet's one of those, and we're supporting the Protos EFW to look at capturing their carbon to put into the ground. And then what that...
As long as you don't capture it and then have to put it on trucks and then move it there. Because if that's what's... I don't know whether that is in the plan. I don't know anything about this project.
Yeah.
But I'm really struggling with the amount of projects out there that are that have got the transportation thing as a solved.
Well, if you're not near a cluster, that's kind of your only option, really. Everybody wants to decarbonize. So, projects are looking at putting in trucks. But it's the ones that are in a cluster that it makes the most sense for. So that's Runcorn as well, like that we talked about at the beginning. That's right in the HyNet cluster. But then if you capture the carbon, because I said it's 50% biogenic content, then you start to be carbon negative. So yes, it would be a big additional capex to install CCS. It would also take a lot of heat, so it would reduce your power output. Hmm. But you would then start to create carbon credits. And so that's potentially another revenue stream. Although it's lots of things in the mix as to whether it's going to, you know, make you money or cost you money.
Hmm. Well, there's another podcast there. Let's do that one day. All right. Two important questions to come. So one, this is your chance. What do you want to plug? What are you working on, or what is Fichtner doing that everyone should know about? This is your chance.
Okay.
And then the second question is a bit harder.
Yeah.
Let's do the first one first. What are you working on?
Okay. So, I mean, I covered it a bit in my, career trajectory, but what I wanted to get across is, yes, Fichtner's been the leading consultancy in energy from waste for a long time, but we're doing everything with energy. And I personally am working on, big 3-gigawatt hydrogen project at the minute. We look at energy storage. We do batteries. We're doing hydro. And we've created a model that we call the Energy Transition Business Case Models, catchy title. But what that helps to do is it uses our expertise that we've built up from working on all these different projects to compare the different technologies in terms of a levelized cost. And we use Monte Carlo simulation to take the range. So all the different inputs have a range, and then we model them to come up with what we think is the most likely levelized cost. And so what I would say is, if you're looking to develop a project, we can help to tell you, what you should build, how much it might cost, whether you'll make money from it, what could go wrong, and ultimately, will it work? And so that's what I'd say. Yeah, that I'd like to push that model.
Okay, cool. Mark, so we'll put in the show notes a link to Fichtner, and you can get in touch with Mark if you want to do that.
Yeah.
And then lastly, probably the most tricky question, which is, what's your contrarian view? What do you believe about the energy transition or what we're working on that perhaps not a lot of other people believe?
So I guess, as we've talked about energy from waste, I wanted to link it to that. So in that energy transition business case model, we've compared levelized cost of generation. And the lowest cost of generation is actually energy from waste, because it is...
The lowest cost of generation is energy from waste.
Yes, lower than offshore wind, lower than onshore wind, because it gets that revenue from the gate fee, and that's what underpins it. So actually the electricity...
The lowest cost in pounds or dollars.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, of generating electricity is energy from waste.
And that's a levelized cost. That includes building the site, running it, and decommissioning it afterwards. Is that right?
Yes. I'm not sure about the decommissioning, probably.
Yes, okay.
Definitely building it, and operating it. So as we said, there are high operational costs. There are high capex costs, pounds per megawatt for energy from waste. But because there is that gate fee revenue, because you get paid for your fuel, which is totally unique for energy from waste, that gives you a low levelized cost of electricity.
I guess in order to, but the thing is, just thinking this through, right? You'd have to burn a lot of rubbish to get there, right? So say it's peak load in the UK is, 45 gigawatts, something like that. Might even be creeping up now, I don't know. How much energy from waste is out there in electrical gigawatt terms?
So there's 1.5 gigawatts of EFW. Roughly produces 3% of the generation in 2021. And that's probably, the 3%, you probably think that's higher, compared to the 1.5, you look how much wind capacity, but the load factor on an EFW is way higher than a wind, because they base load. So that's why it's sort of 3%, which is more than hydro. Solar's about 4%. So
do you guys have to buy carbon? Just buy carbon at the minute, same way that a gas power station has got to buy carbon as an input cost.
So at the minute, they're exempt.
They're exempt?
Yeah. But from 2028, so there's a consultation out there from BEIS, and they're looking to bring them into the ETS from about 2028. And that's what's really going to drive carbon capture.
I was going to say, that'll drive carbon capture. Also, I assume that number's not in the levelized cost number.
It is. So we've run different scenarios. We've run, historic prices, current electricity price, and we've run a net zero scenario.
Fascinating stuff.
And then the only final thing I wanted to add is heat as well. So... I've heard you talk about heat pumps, and I think heat pumps are really good.
Oh, I love heat pumps.
Good solution. So we said coefficient of performance about 4 something for a heat pump.
One in four out. I still don't understand the maths behind that, but 1 in 4 out. What more do you want?
Well, if you were to use CHP, you know, not just from energy waste, but using the energy from waste, then your Z factor, which is the same, right? You know, 1 kilowatt of electricity for 1 kilowatt of heat out. You know, you're looking at, you can get to double figures. So your 4 becomes sort of measly. You can go 7, maybe even 10.
Whoa!
Because you're using the latent heat, right? So when you take steam out, even if you take it at higher pressure, you're condensing it, you're recovering that latent heat, which otherwise goes to the atmosphere. So your Z factor, you know, can be massive. So this is why, you've talked about Scandinavia a lot. So yes, they use heat pumps, but in the cities, they use district heating. And we're really poor at using it in the UK. It's Sheffield and Nottingham, I think, the only cities that have any district heating. Because it's really hard,
you're
right?
Totally right. Okay, so you've done your homework. Big Scandinavian fire, a Scandiphile, if that's even a word. Love heat pumps. Yeah. We have to do some research into CHPs and Z factors, though, because if you can beat 4 out, we should talk about it.
But it's a lot harder.
And you have to burn stuff, I guess. But yeah, with a heat pump, you still have to burn stuff just somewhere else.
Yeah.
Unless you're fully renewable. Anyway, we're going down a rabbit hole again. Look, Mark, I just want to say a massive thank you for coming on. This conversation was fascinating. And for everybody listening, do please hit the good stuff. Like, subscribe, and all the buttons, which mean that we get kudos and our numbers go up. It really does mean the world to us. Thank you very much for coming on, Mark. And see you again soon.
Cheers. Thank you.